Hi, I'm Michael, and welcome to Beyond the Screenplay, the podcast where each week we do a conversational deep dive analysis into a film or a TV show, as today we are talking about the two-episode pilot of Lost, the TV show otherwise known as Questions, the TV show, created by J.J. Abrams, Jeffrey Lieber, and Damon Lindelof, pilot directed by J.J. Abrams. I'm joined today by the Beyond the Screenplay team, Trisha Rand.
Hello, everyone.
Brian Bittner.
Hello, hello.
And Alex Calleros.
Hi.
Okay, so before we get started, our question for people listening on the Spotify app is, what TV show were you most obsessed with? Like, you watched it in its entirety multiple times, perhaps, or just binged it over and over. Let us know.
Passions.
Great, yeah.
I hope that's true.
Yeah, that's Brian's answer.
Yep.
Also, our patron exclusive episode for this month is, believe it or not, Starship Troopers. And that will be coming out either today or tomorrow. I don't know for sure because I'm in the past and you're in the present, but it's either going to happen. But yes, it'll be out no later than the end of the month. So if you want to hear us talk about Starship Troopers, it was a fun episode.
Yeah, we had a blast.
That will be over on the Beyond the Screenplay Patreon. And a reminder for people thinking about joining the Patreon, we have fun perks like a monthly film club where each month we get on a Zoom call with listeners and chat about movies. Last month we talked about West Side Story and the Oscars, and that was fun. And our movie for May is Memento, so revisiting the Christopher Nolan well and the old school Christopher Nolan times. Anyway, so that's what's going on over on the Beyond the Screenplay Patreon. So now, Lost, the pilot episode's two-parter of Lost. So why are we talking about Lost is perhaps a question that people might have. And I feel like for people that might not know, Lost kind of changed everything and was a huge television event, unlike kind of anything that had done before. The pilot, I believe, is still the most expensive TV pilot ever made. And if you watch it, you can see why. It's the set pieces are huge. It's big and loud and expensive. But also even going back to like the script Bible and the way the screenplay is written, like changed so much about like how we write screenplays and teleplays and all these things. And yeah, so there's just a lot to investigate and look back upon with Lost. And it's frightening that we're looking so far back. I didn't realize until I saw the release date that this is an 18-year-old TV show.
Wow.
So I'm going to have to reckon with that at some point. But yeah, so to just quickly kind of share our relationships with Lost before we dive into the nitty gritty. I did not watch Lost the first couple seasons when it was on TV. I was one of those people that was like, everyone's freaking out about this. Like, oh, no, it's like a Survivor like show, but it's like a narrative. Like, whatever, it looks dumb. I don't care. And then I decided with a friend to watch it on DVD because that was back when like TV shows came out on DVDs. We didn't have streaming services back then. And so it was like, yeah, fine, we'll watch it. And then became obsessed and binged all of it. I also remembered I could have been rewatching these episodes on Apple TV because I bought these episodes on iTunes.
Whoa.
Because you used to buy TV episodes on iTunes for like $2.99 an episode, which was weird. They were not good quality. Anyway, so I think I binged the three seasons and caught up for either season four or five live on TV and then like followed it that way. But it's a show that like, if it gets you hard. And it was, I think, maybe the first show that I binged for that reason, because it was available on DVD for me that was watching a little bit later, so that I could and I wanted to sit and watch 22 hours of this TV show back to back to back. and then of course watched the rest of it live on air. And so really enjoyed it, enjoyed the kind of sci-fi aspects of it and just this, you know, the mystery and the questions and wanting to know what happened. Totally like sucked me in and worked, and we don't have to talk about the later seasons because we're here to talk about the pilot. But overall, I was very much a Lost fan, and I think at least have seen it start to finish twice at this point. So yeah, I'm curious for you guys. Brian, what's your relationship with Lost?
I also didn't watch it right when it started. I actually didn't really watch a lot of TV back then. Or if I did, it was like after a show was already done and on DVD, you know, Arrested Development or Freaks and Geeks but I basically wasn't really watching any live TV. But of course people talked about Lost. My friend was a big fan. It was probably around when the third season was out maybe or second, that I just watched a random episode out of curiosity. And that shows you, I think I did this with both Lost and The West Wing. It shows you how different TV was back then, where you're just like, I'll just watch an episode. Right. As opposed, we right. never do that now. It's like, no, you start at the beginning. And even if it takes you, you know, even if like people are like, the first two seasons are rough, but in the third season, it gets, you're like, okay, but I got to watch it in that order. I can't just watch a random episode. And I was curious. And then, I think, you know, my friend had the seasons on DVD box set or whatever, as you did, mm-hmm. and lent it to me. And then I started watching it. And honestly, I never became a huge fan of the show, but there were always questions I wanted answered. So it, you know, it hooked me, as you said. I ended up watching it and then definitely got hooked into the, like, got to watch, you know, tonight's episode. Got to watch it as soon as possible. Go over to friends and watch together, or watch it, you know, the next morning on, you know, abc.com or however you did it back then when you, we could like watch the thing the next morning. Well, DVR, sure. But, online. I am sort of, it's a bittersweet show for me, I think, because I liked it enough to watch it all. But I also wouldn't consider myself really a big fan of the show. And we can get into that a little bit more, but I think the pilot is very solid, and I think a lot of the show is really solid. So let's do it.
Yeah. Awesome. Cool. Trisha, what about you?
Yeah. I definitely at the time was already a J.J. Abrams fan because I was a massive Alias fan. Mm. And I was even a Felicity fan as well. And so, you know, when I heard that J.J. Abrams had a new show coming out, I was just fully on board. But it didn't take long before, you know, to me, Alias was a popular show. And it was a success for ABC. And so, you know, it's not like my love of Alias made me like, in like some kind of niche or like some kind of cool person group where I was a fan of a show that nobody knew about or anything. But I do think I was probably like, it really quickly was like, oh, Lost is for everybody. Like it's everybody. Like Alias is like, if you like women led spy shows, then Alias is for you. But you didn't need to be any particular person. In fact, like that's the whole thing about Lost is that it's for everybody, and literally everybody watched it. My parents watched it. That should tell you right there. It's like, mm-hmm. there are so few shows that my parents and I actually really both liked and watched. And, but yeah, it was just like massive event TV, like nothing you'd ever seen. Like Wednesday nights were Last nights. Like everybody's plunked right down in front of their television sets, and that's what we're doing. And like, I remember I was in college and my roommates and I, like, that was what we would do. And like, we had friends come over. It was just, and then at the end, you just were pulling your hair out. It's like, boom, Lost. And you're like, ah, what did you yep. just do? And you know, even if it wasn't a crazy cliffhanger, which, you know, nearly all of the episodes were, and it's not like Lost was the first show to do that, but it's certainly one of the ones who have done it the best with the cliffhanger endings. And even if it wasn't one of the craziest cliffhangers you've ever seen, it was still like story threads are crazy right now. What will happen with Charlie? What will happen with the hatch? What's going on with the numbers? Are we going to find out? Also, it's like, each episode is kind of about a different character. So who's next week? We just saw a Son and Jin episode. Is it Hurley next week? What's going to happen? Is it Charlie? What's going on? And like, you were never you know, if the next week wasn't your favorite person, you were like frustrated. You're like, no, I have to figure out find out what's going to happen to Claire. And you're just, you know, eternally frustrated. Love triangles. So many. Mm. Like, if that's your thing, it'll just like, there's a million people to ship on this island. And like, that was a lot of the reason that people watched it.
It's a polygon. Who's going to get with who?
Oh my gosh. It's so many.
Tessellation after tessellation.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I love that. I read a quote from a showrunner. I think it was in an interview at the time, or it might have been since then. But he was like, one of the things we liked about the ensemble cast was the many, many love triangles we could create. And I was like, how dare you? But also, I will watch them. Anyway, Lost is a show that I was a massive fan of at the time. I would say I'm still a fan. I'm not such a fan that it didn't frustrate me. As the series went along and, you know, was writing checks that definitely couldn't cash. And I would say, you know, I'm the kind of TV watcher that doesn't get my feelings hurt that easily. Like, so I think that the engine of TV, there's something a little inherently disappointing about it to me anyway. And so I'm kind of expecting to be disappointed by nearly every TV show. And if you go in with those expectations, you can just kind of get on the ride. And so, for example, like I said, I'm a massive Alias fan. The last few seasons of Alias are trash and I don't watch them and I pretend they don't exist. But the first three seasons of Alias I've probably rewatched 5 times. I don't know, something. So that's, yeah. Like, I would watch all of Lost, but I would especially watch the first few seasons at any point. I think they're insanely entertaining. And as you hinted at earlier, Michael, and I can't wait to get into, it's hard to overstate the impact they had on the TV industry and on screenwriting and sort of, TV writing in general. So let's go.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Alex.
Yeah. I think like you, Michael, I think I started watching the third season live, but seasons 1 and 2 I saw probably on DVD. And I think like my boyfriend at the time, that was like early college days. My boyfriend at the time, like, watched a lot more TV than I ever had. Like, I think, you know, in like high school, the only like real TV show I was into was 24, just because it was like this action serial, which also kind of is like part of this early movement towards more serialized dramas. Mm-hmm. Because 24 was 100% just like, this is an hour of like pure like momentum towards a cliffhanger that will not be resolved until next week. And that was very new at the time. It was like crazy. It was like, wow, I actually want to wait until the season of 24 is over to get to rent the DVD at Blockbuster so I can binge the episodes, because it's just too painful to wait week to week watching it live. And Lost was kind of similar. So it was painful watching the first two seasons in a binge format and then getting to season 3, which season 3 is kind of infamous for kind of the first half. They like, there was a budget problem or there was something where like they were just like in cement like cages for a while with like half the cast was gone.
Oh, yeah. God.
Yeah. And it was just like, that was like weird to like get so much like satisfaction packed into like 2 seasons all at once to then like slow drip of nothing happening in season 3. Anyway, so but I mean, watching those first 2 seasons did make me a massive fan, because like the J.J. Abrams mystery box just got me so hard, and it was pointing to so many fun philosophical ideas and sci-fi ideas and like raising so much promise of like, what could the answers be? What is the secret behind all of this? And at the same time, having a great cast of characters that I actually did care about. Mm-hmm. And you know, so it wasn't just the mystery box driving me. I did actually enjoy learning their backstories and seeing their secrets come out via the flashbacks. So there was so much working that I mean, the problem with a show that is this good for this long is that the expectations and the hopes of people like me and the fans just get to a point where there's no way you can possibly end in any way that will satisfy everybody, especially if you haven't figured every element of that ending out in advance, which, you know, this is back when we didn't think of TV shows as having beginnings and ends. It was like you pitch a pilot and maybe your show goes on for 12 seasons. So it's really straddling this moment where we weren't yet in a world where it was like normal to think of your TV show as like having an ending and building toward that ending. And yet it was attempting kind of exactly that in a world in which that just wasn't done. So hugely ambitious. And I agree. It really changed so much and opened up the possibilities for me of like, oh, wait a minute. I always thought about movies being this top dog. I want to work in movies. I want to be a film director. Shows like Lost made me reconsider that, where I realized, wait, this long form storytelling is in some ways surpassing my interest in a certain type of filmmaking, where it's like, wow, the stories you can tell in this medium, if they can get this kind of budget and this kind of cast, like this is almost more exciting in some ways. So it was also a revelation for me as just like an aspiring filmmaker of, wait a minute, what about TV? I didn't even consider TV like somewhere I'd want to go, but this is kind of changing my mind about that. And then, you know, as we know today, now, you know, the lines are all blurred and it's a whole new ballgame.
Yeah, absolutely. I was making notes about the about sort of the difference of TV now and then and or pre then and now, which is, as you said, Alex, like for a long time, for decades, it was just create a world and some characters and then figure out week to week what kind of shenanigans they're getting up to. Right. And the sitcom, the procedural were especially the big examples of this, where it was like there was either no through line at all or the through line was just sort of there, but it didn't really matter from episode to episode. And then now it feels like the opposite. It feels like, you know, some of the Marvel and Star Wars shows are being criticized for being like, they basically are just movies. Why didn't you just make a movie? But then even the longer running shows feel like they are, you know, the Breaking Bad pitch was, we're going to take Mr. Chips and turn him into Scarface. Like, this character will change. Things will happen. Like, that was built into the pitch of a show, which it wouldn't have been before. And then in the mid-aughts, you have this weird sort of time with Lost and Battlestar Galactica and The Wire and The Sopranos, where groundbreaking television that shaped basically what we think of as television today and probably for years to come, but which sort of were somewhere in the middle, which was sort of going like, we are telling a long story and things are going to happen. And like, you know, main characters will die or leave the show, whatever. But we haven't really figured everything out. You know, every once in a while you hear like a season ends with someone knocking at the door. And then the writers say, oh, yeah, we had no idea who was behind the door until we got together to write the next season. I'm like, what? Like, you didn't know what your show was yet. And, and, you know, Lost is an interesting example of, there are these things that are set up in early, you know, even in the pilot, which are absolutely planned to come out later. You know, it's so cool to watch things like someone come by and say, excuse me, in the first episode. And then in the second episode, it's Charlie's story. And you see him do it. Like, that's always really fun to see. Like, oh, you thought this ahead, you know, put it there and we noticed it. And then you notice it here. And then there are other things where they clearly were just kind of making it up as they went along. And, you know, so it's just very fascinating to see where Lost falls in this kind of this changing of the guard of what TV has been and is now.
Well, and one of the things that I think is sort of notable about Lost on a meta level is kind of what you're hinting at here, Bri, with people's expectations. Mm. Like, there was not necessarily an expectation that the writers knew every single thing that was going to happen, but because of the nature of the show, that was kind of like, Lost was really one of the first shows, because of where the internet was and because of where social media was, that the fan base started like analyzing the show. And the breadcrumbs about the mystery were felt so deliberate, and they felt so like, we have a plan for everything. Like, Locke is here talking about Beckham, and he's like, there's a light side and a dark side. And like, the choices that were made about some of the motifs and ideas and the sort of like big philosophical underpinnings of what the show was felt like surely there was a plan. And the internet existed just enough where fans of it, who were everybody, could find each other and just start going wild about what they thought was going on. And like fandom up until that time was kind of like either relegated, like crazy fandom was relegated to like movies. So it was like Star Wars fandoms were a thing and things like that. And there were message boards and, you know, kind of websites where you could congregate and whatever, and sort of start finding each other on some early kinds of social media. But this was really where TV became like, here we have fan sites for Lost and you can read everybody's theory about what the numbers mean. And it's all going to feed into each other. And I shouldn't, it's like also pretty important to remember that the series creators were encouraging that. And they would like do interviews where they were like, oh, I read the fan theory about this, but that's not what it is. And they were kind of interacting with fan theories in a way that, again, kind of makes me mad now, because it's like you didn't know and you were just denying fan theories that you later kind of stole or like affirmed later. But it was part of the whole mythos of the show was maybe you can figure it out. Maybe the clues are there, and like eagle-eyed viewers who really talk to each other and like kind of puzzle it, right? It was a puzzle show, and it, a puzzle show kind of promises that there's a way to solve it. And when it hits smack in the middle of the rise of social media, what you get is this feeding frenzy. And that's kind of what Lost became.
Yeah. Well, and again, with the other technology, like I mentioned, like TV shows were available to rewatch at will in a way that they weren't just a couple years earlier. And so like, you know, you could, other shows you could catch a rerun and tape it maybe. And, but like, this is like, oh wait, what did they say in that one scene from that one episode? Let me pull out that DVD and I will rewatch it. And now I have, you've written down in ink what you promised. And I have that in the back of my head. And that, yeah, just added to the fervor. And, you know, you could stoke fires with that, but also, as you eloquently said earlier, writing checks that you cannot cash at the end of that. And it's also interesting to the script Bible for Lost is famous. And if you haven't looked at it, you should. It's on the internet. You can find it. But there's so many aspects to it that are really fascinating. But one of them that I was struck by, especially, you know, knowing where TV is now for all these reasons that we're saying, where like TV is trying to be like more filmic and cinematic and like get away from like the old idea of what a TV show was, which largely was workplace drama. Like a TV show is a workplace drama, and the Bible of Lost like specifically tries to assuage any fears that an executive might have of like, but wait a minute, this isn't a workplace drama. Like, how are we going to do this? And the Bible literally has paragraphs that are like, no, don't worry. Yes, we're going to have reusable sets. After a couple days on the beach, they're going to move into the caves. The caves will be our like workplace drama. And like, look at all these different permutations. People can drop in and watch an episode and not have to know anything about what happened before. And just like all these things. So it's so at that the beginning of that turning point where it was trying to broadcast that it was gonna be the old thing, it's okay, but found success in this kind of new thing that it was trying to do and then doubled down on it.
The exec who greenlit it got fired like prior to it actually coming out because he had greenlit such an expensive and risky show that was, you know, essentially a sci-fi fantasy show. That was like major genre, like storytelling.
Shot entirely on location. Like all the things.
All in
like,
Hawaii. Just
the
so
reason
much.
You do a workplace drama, there's so many reasons. Part of it is, again, literally a set. You build one set and then you write a million stories that can happen in the set. And so, and you do it inside in a controlled environment. Right. But doing it, every scene is outside on the beach in Hawaii, 22 up. Like that's. It's so expensive and absurd and could never have happened were it not for this weird perfect scenario that created this Lost pilot that blew up and sucked everyone in and week to week was
much like a
profitable.
Jet engine on the beach.
Indeed.
Well, yeah, I mean, speaking of the pilot, it was really fun to revisit it. I'm glad we chose to do this because, man, those opening moments of the pilot are just masterful. Like right off the bat, opening with this image of incongruity where you got the man in the suit with a golden retriever in the bamboo. It just immediately, there's so much happening just in those first images of this is a show that is going to confront you with incongruous images and raise questions. And it's going to just make you feel almost uncomfortable in like these two things don't go together. Like so much of the show is this doesn't belong here. Like this weird, I don't know, pigeon experiment for humans in the cement area. Like, why is this here on this island? Why is this polar bear here? So first you start off with that amazing, just, you know, iconic image of Jack in the bamboo with the dog. And then you go out to this beautiful tropical beach and it just seems like he's in this beautiful place and it's kind of pristine. And you go around the corner and it's just the most insane opening to any mm-hmm. TV show I've ever seen. Just how hard J.J. Abrams directs that sequence and just how intense it is just like nothing you would expect from an ABC drama pilot.
Right. Yeah.
At the time, especially.
Yeah. I was also looking at the like, there's like the structure of it where it's you open on Jack, as you were saying, Alex, he's in a suit, but he's in, you know, in the jungle. Where is he? He's busted up. So it's like already, as you said, these incongruous images. And then we start raising some questions. We have a dog. We have a mini bar bottle. So like maybe that's a clue of what's going on. Then we have a shoe in a tree. So what does that mean? What's going on? And then, like, I would say this is probably the midpoint of this little opening sequence. Now we walk out on the beach and we start to get things, but it's sort of slow. We hear a scream. And then as we start to actually see the people and the wreckage, we're very close on everything. So, you know, we're sort of, I guess, you know, to be in Jack's headspace, it's like you're not really getting the big picture. You're getting like, oh, there's this. And so you're mentally, you're going, it looks like a plane crash. But you're not really seeing things in full yet. You're seeing this person screaming, this thing happening. Okay, that looks like a wing or a propeller or something, you know. Propeller, yeah. the crop duster. But then finally you get this wide shot where you see the plane. You see like several victims at once. But that takes a good probably 3 to 4 minutes to actually get to that. And that's sort of the mystery box, you know, kind of thing in microcosm, which is question, 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 answer, 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 answer. And, you know, the show in macro became question, 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 answer. But like that opening, it just does this like beautiful, like create a series of images, ask a bunch of questions, and then answer them. By the end of 4 minutes, all the questions you've had are pretty much answered and you're ready to go into whatever the next thing is.
And all of that is in the script, which is nuts about the script, is that it's just like, yeah, like shot selection, like extreme close-up. You're only seeing his eye, like very purposefully describing like all the clues. We pull back a little bit, slightly wider, rustling sound. Here's a white Labrador, reverse. Like, it's an odd tableau. Man and dog looking at each other, both entirely out of place. Like, it calls out all of that specifically. Like, the long take that starts facing one way, and then we rotate 180 degrees, and oh my god, it's a plane crash on a beach. Like, all of that is in the screenplay, and the screenplay is written so that you feel that viscerally. Every sentence, multiple times, and it's the screenplay feels like it's punching you in the face constantly with just the momentum of what you're experiencing sonically and visually, and all the tools that will eventually end up on screen are described in detail in the screenplay.
I think you want to read us some of the screenplay.
I mean, I can't. I don't know where to start. It's just like there's. So the reveal of the plane crash is so in the same shot, and I'll try, it's hard to convey. We were talking about this before we started like recording, because like half of this is in all caps and there are dash dashes and dot dots, but like, so yeah, in the same shot, pan as he moves 180 degrees until we're behind him looking out on something absolutely horrific. Only 20 yards away, a plane crash on the beach. 777, passenger airliner, 250-seater, the middle section of the fuselage plowed into the sand, one wing sticking straight up, towering seven stories into the sky, sporadic sparks bursting from the inverted engine, showering down on the absolute mayhem on the sand. And it just like it keeps going, like scattered fires and wreckage, dozens of people running about, some injured, some not. They're helping each other, screaming, sound, enormous jet. Like you just look at the paragraph and it's just like sounds and like visceral images. And there's no, the sentences, are they sentences or is it just a string of
exclamations?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
My popcorn's ready, but I want to continue.
Well, and this is why I always recommend to young screenwriters that they read this pilot. Like, you absolutely must read this pilot. I mean, read any JJ script, because JJ's style and the way that he conveys, especially action sequences, but really just emotion and sort of directorial energy, I want to say, and rhythm on the page is the way that modern screenwriters write. And JJ was really the pioneer of this kind of writing, where it does break a lot of the traditional rules of screenwriting. Like, as Michael just mentioned, it's full of all caps. It's full of like really evocative, but just like onomatopoeia, basically, where he's just trying to like write out the sound that a jet engine makes or whatever, like a plane wing as it's cracking and falling onto the sand. He like tries to write out that sound and dashes at the ends of action lines and the way that he conveys, because some of it is traditionally sort of directorial of like medium close-up of this, we pan around, we see that. But then a lot of it just conveys the emotion that you're going to see on the actor's face.
You should read his sex scenes. Every sound.
No, stop it. Don't listen to Brian. But, you know, this was not the way that screenwriting used to be done. There have been a few different writers that have put like signposts in the sand about this is what it is to write for a reader, to create the scene vividly in the reader's imagination, and in a way that is exciting. And like, one thing Michael has not mentioned, and part of the reason he probably has not read more, is because JJ's screenplays are full of profanity. Like, there is so much, but it's again, it's conveying like, oh my God, this thing is happening. And it's, you know, usually in all caps and it usually has multiple F words in it, but it's conveying the emotion of like what it is to be on the ride of this scene, which in the case of the plane crash on the beach is sheer chaos. And we're just sort of following Jack. But even the way that Jack behaves in that scene, which, you know, we could unpack, is so frenetic and like so panicky and hard to follow, but just incredibly exciting. And so what a way to open a show, and it's all on the page, like every single bit of that tension and the heightened emotion and the panic of it is just on the page.
Yeah.
And speaking of that scene in microcosm, you know, or how this opening is kind of the show in microcosm, I think it also functions that way to introduce Jack's role in microcosm. You know, he is immediately the one feeling responsible for everybody. And the people he's feeling responsible for are very clear archetypes. You know, we have like the mother, almost like the innocent, you know, the pregnant woman. We have like the pretty boy who's kind of dumb, who's like trying to help him, but not really helping. Yeah. You got like a bad boy, you know, scoundrel smoking. Is that, I don't know if he's smoking in that first scene. I think he is. Maybe it's in the aftermath of the chaos. Sawyer.
Yeah.
We just see so many archetypes right off the bat that just scream to us like, okay, that's that type of character. That's that type of character. And in the center of all of them, the person trying to hold them all together is Jack. And it just, it's just amazing to look back on it after seeing the rest of the series and just realize how much work these first moments are doing to establish these roles and Jack's kind of central place in this array of archetypes.
Yeah.
Well, that like the design of the character, I mean, like there's such archetypes to the point that like it's annoying in some like in that JJ way of like I also this time around was like, oh, pregnancy during a crazy opening again. Where did we see that? Just shortly after Star Trek. But yeah, just like the design of this web is also it's archetypes that are also perfectly would be the last people that should be on a right. stranded on an island, right? And like like obvious, like there's a pregnant woman, she's gonna have to have a baby at some point, like that's stress. There is just all the like, of course there's a criminal on here and there's a gun and like all these things that are designed to make the situation as worse as possible and as filled with drama as possible. And either it comes out clearly in these episodes, you know, like where Charlie's there, he's a drug addict and he needs drugs. He's going to run out of drugs one day. So like it's beginning to, you know, lay the foundation of like this drama that will come. So you're seeing that happen either here or it's like laying the further foundation. What's always been fascinating to me is that I remember the Locke episode as being part of the pilot, because I think that's actually where, if you haven't watched it, there's I think episode three,
it's episode four.
Is it four?
It's called Walkabout. Yeah,
right. Where you you get the Locke flashback and understand what he's doing here, and that's when the really starts to lean into like there is some kind of weird magic happening on this island. But like something weird with Locke is set up in these episodes. He has a weird orange moment, and as you pointed out, Trisha, the like, you know, the backgammon thing. So like it's planting the seeds for further things and already tipping its hat at like these are all bombs that are gonna go off soon. Keep watching.
Yeah,
and I think that's a cool thing the show is doing almost all the time, is like on a smaller scale, you do just care about what the characters are doing and what's going to, you know, love triangle kind of questions or whatever, or like a character has a secret or whatever. And then on a large scale, you're like, what the hell is going on? Right. You know, like what is going on? So in this, in these two episodes, we get these questions, some of which get answered. So it's this constant kind of, yarn in front of a cat kind of thing, where like Kate has something going on. Who was in handcuffs? What was Charlie doing in the bathroom? All of which get answered in the first two episodes. So you do get some question and answer. So it's not just I'm confused by all these questions. It's like, oh, no, I got one episode later, I got that answer, right? And then you have things like, Locke saying whatever's going on with Locke. Do you want to hear a secret, right? Sawyer is reading a letter. We don't really know what's going on with that yet. And then we get the bigger, there's a polar bear. Yeah, there's a thing in the jungle that's like taking pilots and trees and whatever. And of course, those are like the big, like, holy crap. Like, yeah, I care about these characters, but what on earth is going on in this whole island? And of course, that again becomes what the entire show is. And I realized both episodes of the pilot end with a question. So it's almost like, you know, it's like the Dan Brown novel of TV series, right? Where you're just like, you're just like, you gave me a little thing. I got to do the next one. So the first ends with them seeing Mr. Greg Grunberg in the tree. And
I love Greg Grunberg. glad to see him in this.
JJ's bestie.
I know.
And the question is, how does something like that happen? And I think I don't remember the exact words, basically like what happened, you know, and then
Charlie gets both questions.
Right,
how does that happen? Right. Is I think the first one. And then, where are we?
Right. The big question at the end of episode 2/ the second half of the pilot, where are we? It's doing, as you're saying, Michael, it's a lot of, we're going to show you where there could be conflict. Like we have established there is a gun or something like that. That's not really a question, but that is sort of a little threat, a little seed that is planted to say this could turn into anything later. But then we have the big questions that we are asking, whether on a character standpoint or on just a macro, what the hell is going on here standpoint.
I think what rewatching the pilot, and I tried to rewatch most of the first season as well in preparation for this podcast, but what it really reminded me is that although now, of course, we think of this as like a sci-fi fantasy show, it really is especially in its first season, a character drama. Mm-hmm. And as you guys are pointing out, what it does wisely in the pilot, when it doesn't have time to dive into every single one of these characters in depth and detail, is take an archetype, utilize it in a way that is helpful shorthand. Here's like a, you know, asshole redneck dude who's here to antagonize everybody and call them offensive names. That's a guy we know and have seen before. But it, as you're saying, Brian, it layers in tiny moments of dimensionality mm-hmm. for him, where we see him reading this letter and it seems like he might cry. And then he decides to go on a walk with everybody for like why? Unclear reasons, which again raises questions. With some of the more central characters, where some of those like more anti-hero kinds of traits are actually brought to light, right? Where we find out that Kate was the prisoner, we find out that Charlie's a drug addict, and some of these other things. Even when those things are there, the dimensionality is still brought in with some nuance and some care. So one of the things that I noticed this time around about Jack is on the beach, he's trying to revive Rose. And he's just trying to get Boone away from him, right? Where he's like, get away from me. You're like ruining, you know, you're just in the way, basically. And so Boone's like, should we do that thing with a pen? And Jack just goes, yeah, that's a good idea. Go get me a pen. And is basically just like, get the hell out of here. But then later, Boone comes back with like 6 pens, right? After like most of the crisis has subsided. And he's like, I didn't know which one would be best. And Jack is like, just takes a kind moment and was like, thanks. They're all great. And just takes all the pens that he does not need. And he didn't need to do that, right? Like, it would have just been easy for that character to be like, get out of here, you know, like, or just discard this person who was getting in his way earlier in a rude fashion. But Jack is not rude, right? Jack is kind. That's his default nature. He, in fact, is too kind and takes on too much responsibility, which is, again, the most, for me, the most beautiful and memorable scene in the pilot is right after that, when finally he steps into the trees by himself and we see that he has a gash in his back. He's done mm-hmm. all of this with a gash in his back that he can't sew up by himself. And so then he like talks Kate through doing it in a way that is so kind and patient, right? Again, he's just like, hey, you know, have you ever used a needle? You know, and he's like, no, you definitely can do this. You can definitely do this. And just keeps encouraging her and talking her through it. And again, being kind and encouraging to her. And it creates this, like, he is, you know, this dimensionality to a doctor character, right? He is brisk, efficient. He will do whatever he needs to get done. Like, once he revives Rose, he immediately runs in the other direction. He's like, okay, you're okay. Deep breaths. Bye. And like runs in the other direction. And there are plenty of times that he, you know, goes off at people and loses his patience. So he is not, it's not that he's not a person. It's that we see what his core characteristics are. And the work of this TV pilot with all of the characters that we're designed to care about the most, with Jack, with Kate, with, in this case, Charlie gets a lot of attention in the pilot episode. Pilot couple of episodes, even with people like Locke and Sawyer, who are eventually going to become big parts of the series, the work of the pilot is to fill them out, sketch them quickly so they're instantly distinguishable, but then fill them out with dimensionality and life and make us care about who they are. And their core characteristics need to be not necessarily virtuous, but relatable. And I think that's the thing about all of these characters. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's an idea of the characteristic first moment. You know, what is the first right. moment right. you introduce a character? Like, what, like, how are they introduced to you? I mean, Sawyer, we really get to know coming in the middle of a fight where he's trying to punch Saeed for, yeah. you know, being brown, basically. and that's a great characteristic first moment for Sawyer. Like, we immediately, like you said, Trisha, know that guy. And this pilot is full of those moments where, I mean, Shannon on the beach doing her nails, even as like wreckage lies around her, is a very the clear character moment. Mm-hmm. And man, thinking about Jack and Matthew Fox, I think, like, what great casting. I think yeah. Matthew Fox somehow like is this perfect energy for Jack. Like I can't really think of anybody else who I could put in his place. And I don't know what it is, but watching the pilot again, I'm like, man, like yeah, nobody else could have been this role. I don't think there's something about Matthew Fox and just there's a bit of a sadness in him, but this yeah. kind of, I don't know, this like puppy dog thing going on. But he so also wounded. Has like, but he has like a strength and kind of like, you can also believe and look at him like, oh, you could be a leader. You can be like a strong center. You're not like a wounded in like a weak way. Yeah. You're wounded in kind of a strong way. Yeah. And man, that I was watching it again, realizing how intense. I remember there was the story about like the spinal surgery, like was a thing in the pilot, but like listening to it again, I'm like, that is a really intense, vivid story. And it kind of struck me for like a, I don't know, ABC drama pilot, just like, just getting really kind of intense and deep with the character really fast, you know, just him recounting what if I was him would be like the most horrifying moment of my life is a really like, I don't know, just diving right into like the depths of his character very early in the pilot. And like, who is this guy? He's a guy who has faced this kind of trauma. Like I might've just paralyzed a girl and I had to just deal with that and keep going. And that's a great characteristic first moment right there too, just showing a backstory moment for a character that is like, he's done this before, he's faced the worst terror that any of us could imagine, and he's learned like a defense mechanism or a way to essentially just work through it. He's maybe the only person here who has that kind of mental ability or training. He's going to be the one that can like keep it together while everybody else is losing their minds and doing their archetype things.
Well, and just talking about the casting, I remember reading that a lot of the characters were written either for the actors that specifically they already knew they wanted to cast. Like Locke was written for Terry O'Quinn. And I think the same thing with Michael was written for Harold Perrineau. But then other characters were created because they saw people in the audition that they loved, but didn't have a character for them. So like Jorge Garcia, who plays Hurley, they didn't have a character for him, but they were like, we got to put him in this. And so they wrote the character of Hurley, and thank God, right? Because now we have Hurley.
I think
they said that Dominic Monaghan read for Sawyer, or I don't remember who he read for. And they also loved him, but they were like, not right for that, but let's, you know, rework one of the characters we already have and kind of make it, you know, work for this. And I think, you know, you don't always have that luxury when you're writing a TV pilot in a vacuum. And in fact, you almost never do. But back in the day when people used to develop shows, like people still develop shows, but not in quite the same way, but they do still develop shows. But, you know, it's really smart that they were open to, listen, if we're going to have an ensemble, let's be open about who the supporting characters are going to be, right? They kind of knew that they had a Jack and a Kate and, you know, Michael and Locke and some of those people. But then let's keep open minds about who can, like, fill out the supporting cast. And I think it was, they said, I think I read too that Daniel Dae Kim was a late addition, and the storyline with him and Sun, which I think is really smart.
Yeah,
all of this stuff is, like, casting. Do good casting and also let your casting shape your character design.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Awesome. Okay. Well, yeah. Why don't we go around and say what lessons we're going to take from the Lost pilot? We've already grabbed several good ones, but so Brian, what's your lesson from Lost?
Yeah. Trisha just touched on a little bit about the dimensionality of the characters. And I was thinking about Shannon while watching this. You know, it's always interesting to watch, go back and watch the early episodes of a show once you know the whole show, right? And I think during our Coda episode, Trisha, you were talking about don't judge your characters. Like when you are writing a character, don't judge them. They don't have to be perfect. And then, you know, so with these characters in the pilot, they all have these sort of pretty clear flaws, or not all, but a lot of them, right? So it's like Kate's a criminal, Sawyer is just a jerk, Shannon is just kind of this spoiled brat, and you could easily just be like, yep, that's who that character is. And maybe if we're lucky in season 3, we'll actually get some dimensionality out of them or something. And but it also it just gives those characters so far to go. And I think that Shannon is such a cool, I keep thinking of like what this pilot is doing in microcosm that the show does as a whole, which I've mentioned multiple times in this episode. And Shannon is such a great example of that because she is like the most spoiled, the most kind of bratty of everyone, especially because we don't meet Sawyer right away. We don't really get to know him until a good, like, I don't know, halfway into the first episode, maybe, or more. But then she talks about the guy who, you know, didn't give him the first class seats and basically saved their lives. And then she makes the choice to go on the hike with everybody. She's like, okay, I will actually help. And it's just this little, and that doesn't mean she can't still be spoiled in later episodes. It doesn't mean she's like, she's three-dimensional, right? She can be this and also that, but it's such a great little example of, oh yeah, these characters are going to change. These characters are going to learn and we are going to love them and feel sympathy for them because we understand where they're coming from. They're not just being these two-dimensional things. And it made me think about actually Sansa in the Game of Thrones books and in the show as well, but especially in the books, it was like, each chapter of those books is from a certain character's viewpoint. And you generally love the characters that get the viewpoint. But Sansa is like, wait, why am I reading a Sansa chapter now? I don't care about her. I don't like her. You know, I like Arya. I want to go hang out. But then because you spend time with her as a similar character, as sort of the spoiled character, then you start to learn where she's coming from and what her ideology is, and you feel more sympathy for her. And then when she goes through what she goes through in those books and the show, again, it's such a far way to go and you feel so much more invested. They become such a more interesting character because you let them come from this place that you maybe wouldn't want your perfect character to be. You know, you'd be like, this guy, like Jack, right? Jack's likable, he's great. And then the show in later seasons maybe will say like, well, what if we did this? ? But someone like Shannon or Sansa in Game of Thrones books, like, no, let's just show you right away you don't like them and then pull you out of that, right? And then start to like create this dimensionality. So I just think it's I think Lost did that with a lot of its characters, but Shannon is the first very clear example of that.
Yeah.
It's also JJ manages this, not really related, but thinking about the moments of like Shannon on the beach, JJ manages to kind of like artistically justify his objectification of people in a way that I'm like, yeah. Oh, that's a neat trick that I guess you pulled off.
Are you talking about Kate like washing her hair in the ocean?
Right. That's the other moment.
I was like, sure.
Right.
Jack taking the shirt off. I mean,
I'm here for some of that.
Yeah. But it's always like somebody else is watching them. And it's technically kind of like a character moment because like Shannon, when she's like in her bikini, like does the shower, pants past her. But then it cuts to Emile DeRay, Claire's character.
Emily DeRay, yeah.
Right. Like thinking about like, I used to, anyway, it was just funny. Like, watching, you know, all of that play out.
It's just narratively motivated skin.
Right. We have to find some way to get this in here. So let's, if we kind of justify
it's a desert
it,
island. It's, I mean, you don't have to be that creative to like get it.
Right. People are going to get naked.
Yeah.
Awesome. Cool. Alex, what's your lesson?
I was really struck this time watching it, remembering the beautiful moment where Jin is going around with the like sea urchin meat and nobody wants it. And it's just like, oh, this is gross. But then he gets to Claire and there's a whole, it's a really like just kind of slice of life scene. It's almost like a one long take where she keeps rejecting it and like, I don't want to, but I'm going to be polite. I'm going to have it. And then it culminates with, you know, the magic sea urchin meat kind of makes her baby kick and shows that her baby is still alive. And it's just this beautiful, simple, sweet moment where, you know, Jin's excited, she's excited. And I think it's really important to have moments like that in this pilot because that is also what the show is going to be. It's going to be about a community forming and people just kind of having connections they never would have had in their past lives that are going to form on this island. And I just think it's a good reminder that in a story that's otherwise very intense or full of drama and violence and, you know, these horrifying plane flashbacks that are like so intense, it's wonderful to have like the palate cleanser of like an up moment where two people are just like happy about something in a very genuine way. And so, and it was very smart for this episode to make sure that was in there as well, because that is what the show also is and why we love these characters ultimately. Mm-hmm.
And it's doing the dimensionality thing we were just talking about, right? Where it's like you present Jin as this very two-dimensional character. Right. It's like, you can't do this, and we don't want to trust them, and we don't want to whatever. And then you get this moment where it's like, oh, no, he is absolutely a human, and we are going to love him eventually.
Yeah.
It was hard to remember that I was going to love Jin eventually.
Yeah.
Like, right. He's yeah. really the worst in the first few right. episodes.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and that, you know, the pen moment that you talked about earlier, Trisha, I feel like it's doing that also, right. where it's heart and it's, and there's humor, like, somehow in amidst all of this. And they, like, take care to, like, make those as important beats as everything else. And I think that goes a long way to exactly what you were saying, Alex. Yeah. Trisha, what's your lesson?
So when we were doing our Star Trek episode, we were talking about how JJ shoots action things. And also shoots things that are not action like they are action. I was really struck by the closing scene of the second part of this pilot, which is five characters standing around listening to a walkie-talkie. And it's the most intense action-y thing you've ever seen in your life. And I was looking at the construction of the writing in that scene, and it's so smart. Like, so obviously the way that it's directed, the camera is like, circling around them and like pushing in on people and like cutting. It's really, you know, kinetic, but there's so much conflict happening in this group of people who are literally just standing on a hillside listening to a walkie-talkie, right? Everyone's like, Shannon, you speak French. She's like, I do not speak French. They're like, would you please just try and listen to this? I've heard you speak French. So there's one argument happening over here. Meanwhile, Saeed and Kate are trying to figure out what the sequence of numbers means. Then Saeed starts doing math really quickly. And meanwhile, the battery is dying. So there's this ticking clock and like everyone's freaking out and panicking. And it is a brilliant piece of writing for the cliffhanger at the end of this, right? It's not a big, and it's not another big encounter with the smoke monster. And like, once you've had that plane crash at the beginning, you can't go bigger, right? You can't go like big set piece or I guess maybe you could, but it's super smart to just be like, we are going to give you some devastating information. And the scene in which we are going to give it to you is also going to feel insanely intense. It's highlighting all of the interpersonal conflict. There's this really, really short ticking clock that makes it feel like a bomb is going to explode. And meanwhile, the characters are like doing math and translating French. And it's just jam-packed with, like high tension. And it feels like high stakes. Like, what if they don't translate it before the battery dies? It's so good. Like, it's what JJ does like really, really well. Right, where characters are zooming in with information at the last minute, and meanwhile, other things are happening, and meanwhile, people are having character moments and character conflict and all of this stuff. It's great. Yeah, the image of Shannon just like kind of crying with the thing pressed to her ear while she's like listening and being like, it killed them all. And then Saeed is like, 16 years. And everyone's like, what? Like, it's so good. I feel like you could break it apart even more.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it is just that the stakes are their stakes, right? It's not just the stakes of what happened to this person. It's whatever happened to this person is, you know, potentially what's going to happen to us. And that makes the stakes feel huge.
Yeah.
And it's like potentially the first big answer, right? It's the first voice that they've heard from, you know, someone not on the island or not crashed. And yeah, so I was also noticing that sequence has always like stood out to me, but it announced itself more overtly to me this time because it's the shot that kicks it off is like right before like Saeed is calling to someone. It's like, you know, I got the signal. And then Saeed like turns around 180 degrees, not for any reason. He doesn't need to be facing one way or the other to look at his walkie-talkie. But like, it's a big dramatic movement that then lets us cut to a shot where now we see someone running down the hill behind him to get to Saeed, and we can start the like dulling around that you're talking about. And just like, yeah, it's such like melodramatic, kinetic, insane writing and filmmaking. And it's great. And that's what like Lost is.
It's what JJ does so well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What's your lesson, Michael?
Yeah. Revisiting this was a really interesting kind of walk down like form memory lane, because we've been talking about how film and TV and everything has evolved so much, and we don't have TV shows like this anymore, like as much, where the goal of the show, as we hinted at earlier, is like to create an engine for drama and entertainment week after week, ideally for infinity, right? Like, and this show is just, it's like the pinnacle of a great engine for endless drama, where you have just a very visceral, primal situation, right? Survival. You've crash landed on a desert island. How are you going to survive? Like, eat, drink, like all these base primal things. You have character drama that is, you know, a big ensemble cast where there's infinite combinations of conflicts and love triangles, as we've talked about, but also an added three-dimensionality that we were just talking about, that I think is also enforced by the mechanism of flashbacks, because in this show, we're also going to get flashbacks where we're going to learn more about the people and how, why they came here. And that's going to inform so much of this. And so they have to be interesting because they're going to hold entire episodes sometimes.
They also have so many secrets.
Right.
You know, they have to have so many secrets because that's what's going to be uncovered in the flashbacks.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then, yeah. And
no,
then
it's just like, I don't know. I felt like a trip to LA. Yeah. LA is normal. Here's my normal family. Like, I'm on vacation. I'm going to Disneyland.
Yeah. All those people are in the background are dead. We don't need them. But, and then you have, this insane, like clown car of a mystery box where you can just, it starts like focused enough that you have all the questions that you need for a season, but then a season two can be like, we found a hatch. What's inside the hatch?
Right.
Or like, I guess that's part of the season, but like that simple question of like, there's a door we can't open sustains so many episodes of drama. And then you get to open the door, and what's inside the door? More questions. Like, so you can be operating. Lost is at its best, I think, when it's operating on all three of these levels, where it's the survival meets the characters, meets the flashback, meets the mystery box, are all kind of coming together. But you can offload weight to each of those as needed to generate 22 episodes of a television show a year, which is crazy to think about at this point. And it's just so impressive. And it almost made me like, I'm a little sad that we don't have this anymore, because I think it is a unique kind of storytelling that, you know, has maybe had its time, but rewatching this pilot made me be like, but there was craft to that was pretty impressive.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the danger, of course, is that you oversaturate all of the stuff, you know, like, you know, a show like Lost or Broadchurch, it's like, everything. Oh, a character has a secret, right? These characters have secrets. And then it's like, well, now we have another season. Well, they had more secrets that we didn't know about. Now we have to come up with new ones. Yeah. And of course, normally you do what you were talking about, Michael, which is like, oh, here's a hatch. Here's a brand new thing. But it's like, but we have established this flashback thing. So now we have to establish that like these characters had other lives that we haven't even gotten to yet. And like, you didn't even know that this guy knew this guy in the past, whatever. And that's not a criticism of anything, really. It's just the danger involved. Designing something that's meant to go on forever, but is also meant to reveal a bunch of secrets, is like, you really have to balance that.
Yeah, totally. Also, cautionary tale. You have to be careful. Lost. Yeah. You can learn everything from Lost. Why don't we go around and say, what we've been watching recently. Alex, what have you been watching recently?
So I've been listening to an audiobook, which I'm really enjoying, which is The Fifth Season by N.K. Jemisin. Mm. And it's like a Hugo Award winning sci-fi series called the Broken Earth series. And I've always heard about it as a great example of world building, just like an incredible world building in a sci-fi fantasy universe. And that is absolutely true. I'm just really, really enjoying just how compelling and fully thought out a kind of a weird, it's like an ecological what if sci-fi world, where just everything's been thought down to like, okay, what if this ecological situation was present? How would, over like centuries of time, culture evolve? And also, what if this kind of magical fantasy element was present? how would culture and politics evolve around that element? And it's so rich and rewarding to go into a world that is that fully thought out, but also has really great main characters with really compelling stakes right from the beginning. So highly recommend it if you're looking for just a good, rich, new, interesting sci-fi fantasy story world to dive into. The Broken Earth series so far, I am really, really enjoying.
My nice. Sci-fi fantasy book club read that book, but I didn't go that month. So I've heard good things.
Wow.
I just thought that would be an insightful addition to your recommendation.
Thank you, Brian.
Well, yeah, The Fifth Season by N.K. Jemisin.
Excellent. Well, Brian, what did you see?
I did not read that book because I was busy seeing The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, starring Nicolas Cage as Nick Cage, and Pedro Pascal as Javi, a mega fan of Nicolas Cage who hires him to come to his birthday party for $1 million. Because Nicolas Cage just needs $1 million at this point in his career. And they form kind of a surprising bond. It just ends up becoming a bromance. But also, is Javi involved in some really untoward business that he shouldn't be? And Nick Cage has to become sort of a secret agent to get to the bottom of it. Basically, it turns into a 90s Nick Cage movie, and it delivers so hard on the premise. Like, it's one of those, just like Everything Everywhere All at Once, it's a movie where you see the trailer and then you see the movie and you're like, yeah, that's exactly what I wanted from that trailer, and even more. And I saw it at a packed theater, like a sneak peek with a Nicolas Cage costume contest and big foam Nick Cages and wow. masks that were handed out to everyone so we could all be Nicolas Cage. And so, of course, it was just like the most rowdy, fun time I'd had in the theater in quite a while. But whether or not you could see it in the theater, check it out. It was just a blast.
Doesn't it also have like 100% Rotten Tomatoes, or it did for a second?
It did for a bit.
It has insanely good reviews, which I was not expecting.
Speaking of expectations, it's a movie where it's like, you there's no way you could expect this movie to be anything else. So like, did it deliver on your expectations? Hopefully, yes.
Fascinating. Cool. Okay. Well, to just continue my little train that I'm on, I watched John Wick Chapter 2.
nice.
It's such a weird story world, but it was still like really entertaining, and there's just something about Keanu where you just want to watch him do stuff, and I feel like this Chapter 2 leans on that more than the first one did. It's really fun, and like there's some cool action scenes, and Common shows up for some reason, and he's like one of the hitmen, and like they have a cool, but like also, yeah, you're getting into this world of these assassins that take, you know, the idea of like, no, I'm touching home base, you can't shoot me, like really seriously, like to the point where I'm like, is this how serious we're trying to be? But I don't know. Yeah, I just have never seen a movie action series like it, and it was fascinating. So,
how many of them are you going to watch, Michael?
Well, I'm going to watch all the ones I can. And then the fourth one comes out next year, I believe. And there's a fifth one that they're working on also.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. There's a scene where they're walking through public places shooting at each other with silencers on their guns. Yep. And I'm like, I don't think that's how that works, but like, cool. which is kind of, I think that's kind of how I felt the whole time. And two of like,
I don't think
that's how that works, but cool. So I'm enjoying myself.
Nice.
Cool. So Trisha, I should say that this episode of Beyond the Screenplay is sponsored by Mubi, and you have a film to recommend that is on Mubi, if I'm not mistaken.
I do indeed. So a little while ago, recommended Benedetta, which is Paul Verhoeven's movie that came out last year. Mm-hmm. And it stars this French actress whose name I'm going to attempt to not butcher, Virginie Efira. And I really love her. And the reason I really love her is because she's also in a film that I saw called Sybil, which is directed by a French director named Justine Triet. And Sybil came out in 2019. And it's this psychological drama kind of. Virginie Efira plays a therapist, and she's also like a moonlights as like a novelist kind of. And she decides to start stealing the details of one of her patients, like her life, and writing them into her new novel. And so she kind of gets obsessed with this patient of hers and like starts following her, kind of trying to like get more details from her life so she can use them in her novel that she's writing. And the patient that she's following around is actually an actress. And so, and she's, you know, the patient herself is very troubled. And so she is relying on Sybil, the main character, her therapist. And so she invites Sybil to go with her on set to a film shoot that they're shooting, a movie in like Greece or something. And so like a lot of it actually takes place on a film set where there's like the star of the movie is this actress. And then Sybil plays, you know, is her therapist who's using her to write her novel. It's all this like twisted psychological entanglement. It's really great. I really, really enjoyed it. And it is on Mubi right now. So you too also can check it out.
That sounds like, yeah, a really interesting premise. I'm very curious.
Yeah,
that's
great.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So if you don't know, Mubi is a curated streaming service showing exceptional films from all around the globe. Every day, Mubi premieres a new film, from brand new work from emerging filmmakers to modern masterpieces from today's greatest icons. There's always something new to discover. With Mubi, each and every film is hand-selected, so it's kind of like your own personal film festival, streaming anytime, anywhere. If you want to try Mubi for free for 30 days, simply click the link in these show notes, or if you're watching on YouTube, click the little pop-up that happens in the top right. Or simply head to Mubi.com/beyond the screenplay. That's Mubi.com/beyond the screenplay for a whole month of great cinema for free. Thank you to Mubi for sponsoring Beyond the Screenplay. And thank you guys for listening to our conversation on Lost. This was really fun. And I want to say I was afraid that going back was going to make me want to rewatch all of Lost. I think luckily I don't feel that way, but there are some moments that I want to kind of jump around and relive, like
How I feel.
The
season premiere, the Desmond time travel episode, really bad.
That one I watched with friends.
It's like, so good
live, and it was just like nobody, you could hear a pin drop in the room.
And just like the season two premiere where like it starts and you're like, where are we? And this music's playing. And then you hear the boom and you're like, we're inside the hatch. Like that blew my 18-year-old brain like all the way off.
That was the episode I watched when I wanted to just check out an episode of the show.
Oh my God.
What?
Oh,
wow. No. Yeah.
No idea what the hell was going on.
Oh my God. Painful.
That was so good. Wow. Cool. But yes, thank you everyone for listening. We want to say a big thank you, as always, to the patrons that make this show possible. If you want to help us make more episodes and get fun perks like voting on what our monthly patron exclusive episode will be, head over to the Beyond Screenplay Patreon. The link is in the show notes. Thank you to our producer, Vince Major. Thank you to our editors, Caleb Berg, Graham Harther, and Eric Schneider. I'm Michael Tucker, and I've been joined today by Trisha Rand, Brian Bittner, and Alex Kayotis. All of our Twitter handles are in the show notes. Send us a tweet and say hi, and we'll see you in the next episode.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.